A big one was really also going deep into the mental health space, looking at where is AI currently and kind of like exploring this intersection. A big point for us was seeing how extremely well-structured therapy is and how well-suited it really is to be modeled with AI. I think oftentimes people from the outside would have the perspective that therapy is much more of an art than a science. It's like this white magic that some people are gifted to do and they like suddenly help people feel better, but it's actually much more of a science. And it's a well-documented process, similar to an algorithm from the computer science perspective.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Ignite podcast. Today we're delighted to have a Team Ignite portfolio company co-founder, Chris Aberle, on the program. He's the co-founder of Sonya. They just came through the Y Combinator winter batch. He's from Switzerland, went to ETH Zurich, MIT, and is building a really cool app that we were really impressed by. So welcome to the program. Thanks for coming on. So Chris, would love to get an intro from you for the audience.
Sure. Yeah. So you covered part of it. My name is Chris. Originally grew up in Switzerland, in Zurich specifically, spent there most of my life. Very technical background, very geeky, nerdy kid, liked math, liked game theory, all of those concepts. Ended up studying computer science at ETH. It's actually where I met my two co-founders, Dustin and Lucas. We all did undergrad together, did some other things on the side, as you said, played a bunch of poker, did that as a side job, a lot of studying.
Is that like a college hustle? Like you're out taking people's money at poker games?
It's funny how it started. I don't know if you know the movie 21. That's kind of my big inspiration for life back in the days. I watched that when I was around 15. MIT kids making money by using math and logic, and I thought that's like a pretty cool concept. So yeah. I think I set my two life goals, at least for the next like 5-6 years, A, learning how to make money with card games. Blackjack didn't work anymore, so I did poker, and obviously the second goal, getting to MIT. So that kind of like influenced very much my 15 to 20 years life, which I think others spend in more fun ways than I did, but it was quite the right. So did that. Tiny stop also had some internships, spent a tiny bit of time at McKinsey, then moved to Boston, did my master's at MIT in business analytics / data science, so very much applied AI, working with large companies, seeing all of their archaic data sets and having to navigate through those, trying to extract some amounts of signal, which was sometimes very hard. Explored a bunch of industries at that point in time. That was also the big like crypto boom. I thought that was interesting to some extent from a lot of game theoretical perspectives. Was working on some projects with NASDAQ on how to fight misinformation, like how can we align incentives in a way that information is shared. So like game theoretically have the right environment where people are more truthful. So just like a lot of curiosity exploring. Ended up being, as I call it, a very unofficial entrepreneur in residence at Verkada. Was there for 6 to 8 months, something around that, just hacking on my own projects, being mentored by the co-founders, learning how to build a company until last summer when we went back to Boston and started Sonya while Dustin and Lucas were just finishing up their master's research at MIT.
That's really cool. What was the kind of genesis for Sonya?
Yeah, I think there's some
aspects. What is Sonya so the audience knows? Yeah.
100%. So Sonya is an AI mental health therapist that conducts entire text and voice-based therapy sessions via phone app. We're live on the iOS App Store. People can have entire 30 and also 5-minute therapy sessions. There's interactive elements to it. Try to replicate very similar the structure of how it would be in physical therapy with a human therapist, but obviously making that infinitely more accessible to people who cannot afford to see a therapist. That's the brief overview of Sonya. And
very cool.
Your question on how it started, there's several aspects to it. I think fundamentally, all three co-founders of us were very frustrated with the state of the mental health industry. Obviously, demand is ever rising. So many people are struggling with their mental health while supply is extremely limited. And I think what's very important to just like make very clear here is we think human therapists are amazing. They're actually the inspiration behind Sonya because they are so effective. The problem is just the access to therapists. And I fundamentally think even back to when I was like 16, the goals I set for my life is I think making people happier is one of the most meaningful things you can do in the world.
Yeah.
That was one of my main optimizations. And the second was building a large company because I just think that was a very exciting, big, challenging thing to do. And obviously Sonya is perfect in a way that it perfectly aligns those two goals.
Yeah,
the way we build a large company is by making people happy. And that's just like also personally extremely fulfilling and motivating to work on. I was just saying like that's probably more like the personal and emotional angle to the side of how we started Sonya. And I think a big one was really also going deep into the mental health space, looking at where is AI currently and kind of like exploring this intersection. A big point for us was seeing how extremely well-structured therapy is and how well-suited it really is to be modeled with AI. I think oftentimes people from the outside would have the perspective that therapy is much more of an art than a science. It's like this white magic that some people are gifted to do and they like suddenly help people feel better, but it's actually much more of a science. And it's a well-documented process, similar to an algorithm from the computer science perspective. So we had kind of had this insight now, we have this big enabler of AI. AI itself can't just do therapy with a prompt, but we can actually leverage this technology to really conduct the therapy session in a similar way that a human would, which we kind of thought is a pretty great task to work on.
Yeah, I love that. What is it about the timing? I mean, obviously ChatGPT and large language models, all that stuff. What is it about the timing where it's the right time for this?
Sure. I think there's two aspects to it. Obviously, AI is the big one. I'm happy to go more in depth there. But I think a second big enabler is the social trend. I think 10 years ago, going to therapy is something you would have wanted to hide from your friends, which I don't think is a great basis for building a consumer product around it. And I think we're moving into the direction, which I think is fundamentally very good also for the world in general, where people are proud to seek a therapist. It's something cool because it shows that you care about your mental health. Mm. It's very clear that it's correlated to your mental health and your productivity, your happiness, and everything around that. So that's a big enabler for us. But then obviously the big one being AI. And I think what's cool about our enabler here is it's at the perfect balance of making this entire thing possible while we're not worried about it replacing this entire thing. But I think like, there's many technologies which are built on the brink of currently with GPT-4 and like the state of current LLM models, they can still survive, but like some more advancements on the base model side and they're going to die. And I think fundamentally, like we're excited the better base models get, because the better base models get, the more we can leverage them to like actually do the domain specific tasks. So I think it's like this cool balance of it wouldn't be possible without them, but their pure existence doesn't make it easy. But it enables us to do the hard work on the therapeutic side.
And then from a technical perspective, are you guys using like a Llama 3 or something? Or are you guys using a fine-tuned ChatGPT-4? Like what's your tech stack look like?
Yeah, we're using a bunch of different LLMs. We started very much just using OpenAI's models.
Yeah.
Also from the perspective of splitting up into kind of two tasks, right? There's one's the task of just generating the replies, which is like you say, send a message to Sonia, either by voice or by text, and you get a response, which is fundamentally like the only task that gets exposed to the end user, but it's only the very, like almost like the tip of an iceberg. It's what's exposed, but it's very easy. And I think much harder is the entire reasoning. Mm. And that's where we are fine tuning our own models to have those reasoning engines and like have those fine tuned to the specific task at hand based on like where within the conversation the user currently is and how that evolves over time to have relevant context.
Yeah. And I would imagine you have to work on kind of short-term, long-term kind of memory modules as well, right? Because you have this person, they've all the things they've said, all the kind of the insights. Hey, I remember you talking about, you know, this story, that person, and you have to somehow store that. How are you guys accomplishing that with these, you know, context windows? They are getting longer, of course, but I'm guessing you have to do some sort of recursive kind of long-term memory storage, kind of maybe how the brain works.
Exactly. Yeah. And the last thing you said is spot on. We literally just try to replicate the way that a therapist's brain works. Mm. Like actually, the thought process they go through is what we try to implement on the retrieval side. Because even if context windows get larger, we can't just insert all PDF transcripts because that has a terrible signal to noise ratio, right? Even if it would be theoretically possible from the token size, it wouldn't contain the important
information. It's not how our brains work anyway. It's not how a therapist's brain works anyway. They don't remember verbatim everything the patient says. They remember the gists, the stories, the patterns.
And it's almost like a multi-step process, right? Because first you need to know like what is the context around the current conversation. Because fundamentally, like in the beginning of the session, when it's much more about like getting an update from the last week or how the patient has been doing, you fundamentally need to retrieve different information and have access to different pieces of data than you would have, for example, later on in a therapy session when it's about like setting concrete tasks and to-dos for the patient to do until the next session. Yeah. It's kind of like this awareness of where you are and based on that, being able to retrieve explicit things about the patient.
Yeah, how have you found the engagement with the platform thus far? I would imagine, just kind of as a thought experiment, if there was an AI that I could talk to that was a therapist, I would probably be more, like knowing that it's an AI, I would probably be more vulnerable, open, and honest with it. Like, yeah. How do you find, patients and people?
I think it depends and varies a lot across the population. There's exactly the type as you describe it, who is much more open to using a therapist. And one interesting demographic we've actually been speaking to quite a bit is also veterans. Because veterans, I think, oftentimes have this perspective of having gone through really terrible situations and this sense of like nobody back home can ever understand what I've been going through. And they almost appreciate the fact that Sonia is not a human, right? Sometimes we need to almost like hide that Sonia is not a human. And like obviously we make clear disclaimers, right? But then like you still get an environment in which you feel comfortable opening up. But
yeah,
there's also those cases where it's really like, this is an AI, this is not a human. And people are like, okay, wow, then I can open up. But then clearly, right, like there's also people who are saying like, oh, I would never talk to an AI, which I think is like gradually shifting to becoming less and less people, but they clearly still exist.
Yeah. And then you guys started with cognitive behavioral therapy, right? That's my understanding.
Yeah, exactly.
Why that particular type of therapy for this kind of application?
Yeah, there's several reasons. I think CBT is very broadly applicable, which just makes it easy for us to already have broad reach very early on. CBT is great for all sorts of anxiety disorders, for depression. There's obviously cases where CBT is not very applicable, but I think it's a very broad spectrum of how you use CBT. And the second big one is that CBT is extremely well structured. And the more structure you have in your therapeutic approach, the more easily and more safely, also importantly, you can guide it with AI. I think some parts of like psychoanalysis are oftentimes much more open-ended and don't really have like a rule or algorithm-based system on how you actually conduct the therapy session, whereby that is usually nicely defined in CBT, and there's a lot of variations clearly, but the more algorithmic structure you have, the easier it is to leverage that with AI.
It's really cool. And thinking about cognitive behavioral therapy, like what is it exactly for folks that aren't interested or aren't familiar with it?
Yeah, so cognitive behavioral therapy or CBT is a therapeutical talk therapy approach that essentially helps you understand, catch, and reframe your automatic thoughts. And it's very much based on the cognitive model of CBT, which is essentially saying that you go through life experiencing situations, right? Situations happen. We're on a podcast right now. Yeah. Afterwards, you might have lunch, something around that. And usually what happens in the way that many people go through life is they only perceive their situations and then resulting emotions or behaviors. You're like, oh, I did this and I felt terrible. Or I did this and then I avoided the situation and I went home. And oftentimes what happens between those situations and those emotions is that you actually have automatic thoughts. Those automatic thoughts being like, oh, I hate being here. Oh, people will judge me. And that's why you then avoid or you leave the party. The party being the situation, leaving the party being the behavior. And CBT teaches you about catching what are those thoughts that actually happen in between those two steps, which are often so implicit and so quick that many people don't even realize them. And it's about, A, like even catching them, which is the hard part, but then being able to learn what are patterns and similarities across those thoughts. And those boil down more to either intermediate beliefs or really like those core beliefs about you feeling either unlikable or you feeling generally lonely, worthless. And really like trying to dig deep on where all of those come and helping you see those from different perspectives with a broad range of techniques and tools.
It's very interesting. So it almost sounds like a guided meditation therapy in a way. You know, because the meditation, you're meditating on some object, your breath, whatever sensations, and you sort of learn to shortcut the spiral loops of your monkey brain, right?
Yeah.
Is that an accurate assessment? Yeah.
I think a big similarity is awareness, right? In meditation, you often just want to be there, present in the moment, focus on your breath and your thoughts as they come and go.
Right.
And that's exactly what also CBT is trying to teach you. Being able to perceive those thoughts in the first place, because only then can you work on those thoughts, right? If you never even know what they are, like how should you restructure, reframe them, or like challenge them potentially?
Yeah, I love that. So what are you guys excited? I mean, let's talk about the YC experience for a little bit. So you guys got in on your first try. There's a lot of repeat applicants.
Yeah, I applied a few times. I applied like right out of MIT, didn't take that too seriously. I mean, obviously took it seriously, but like I just thought like, okay, let's give it a shot, see if it works. And then the second time around, got to the interview stage, dropped off there, which is retrospectively pretty good because what we were working on was stupid. And Dustin was kind of still at MIT at that point. So it all wouldn't have worked out perfectly. And then this time around, it went pretty fast. We didn't even originally plan to apply, but then a few days before deadline, we were like, okay, let's just send it off. And then I think two hours before deadline or something, we finished it, heard back 48 hours later, which was right after hackathons, and we've been hacking for like 40 hours straight, and then we found out, okay, our interview's tomorrow. I think like the day after, something that. So we kind of had one day to prepare for that. But that went super smooth. Our group partner was Serbi. She's great. Interview went relatively straightforward. And yeah, pretty much like 4 days after applying, we were in YC.
That's amazing. And then kind of walk us through the process of, you know, YC. How was that process for you? I guess you guys raised everything right around demo day.
Yeah. YC overall, amazing experience. Started off with the retreat, which I started doing again now, where they, for the first weekend, just take all founders and put them together in a hotel somewhere north of San Francisco and just meet everybody in a super chill environment. And you start realizing how smart everybody is, which I feel is a great start. Also very motivating. You find out what people are working on. Like, they encourage you. They already help you out in some parts. And from then on, we basically just locked ourselves into our apartments. We honestly didn't do that much networking during YC. We weren't like the ones who just went on every single event and breakfast brunch, of which many exist during the batch. We had a great apartment, great setup with laptops, monitors, hacked a lot. Then obviously what is great about YC is for our group, it was Monday events. Every Monday evening, we had guest talks, we had dinners, just got back together with group partners and all other batch mates, reconnected with them, had our office hours also on Monday. So kind of like Monday was our day when we spent on YC campus. Then I think the biggest thing for us was there's a Slack channel where you get engineering support. And that just has 500 people, and 500 of the smartest people ever in the Slack channel. And whenever you have any sort of question or any roadblock from a product standpoint, you post in a question, and 2 minutes later, you'll have an expert who's worked on exactly that for the last 10 years or so, it seems.
Oh, wow.
Which just like accelerates you infinitely. So
I wonder how they do the really matchmaking on that. Is it just like every engineer is just kind of watching all the messages? I imagine it has to be a community manager kind of going, oh, it's, you know, this blah blah thing in the tech stack. Let me find the person and, you know, at sign them.
I think what's special about YC is that people also really enjoy helping. So you actively monitor that Slack channel to see if there's something that you could help with. Which I think that is unique, right? Usually you only get the people active who ask questions and have the problem. But like YC is such a close-knit community that people are equally excited about just sharing and helping as they are about like getting answers to their questions.
Is it the Slack channel? It's all the same batch mates all helping each other, basically, right? So it's like all, like most everyone in YC is an engineer, I'd say probably 70-80%, right? And so it's just all of you watching all of your questions flow through and just kind of seeing where you can jump in.
Exactly. I mean, there's a bunch of like sub channels, but there's one specifically for engineering, which we found to be extremely helpful.
I never realized that. I guess that makes sense when you're kind of going through it in a cohort model. You know, you're going to be like, okay, we're the winter batch 24. You guys get like a nickname or something? Do you guys call yourselves something? Or is it just winter batch 24?
It's just W24.
The W24s, maybe. Yeah.
We should have, though. It would have been more creative, I agree.
Yeah, something like that. Anyway, I love this app. When I met you during the program, I was like, okay, this obviously needs to exist, and obviously it felt like the right time. But I think what really excited me about it was, you know, therapy has been this really expensive, hard to get kind of thing for a lot of people, and now, and same with like, you know, 10 years ago with like, you know, apps like Headspace and Calm, right? That really democratized access to really high quality meditative practices. I think Sonya has the potential to basically democratize access to therapy, which really excited me because, you know, I don't know how many, you probably have the stat, but you know, what is it? 30, 45 million Americans are suffering from various forms of depression or PTSD.
And yeah, it's like 70 million each year.
70 million each year, which is a ton. That's 20-25% of the population. And a lot of them are afraid or worried or stressed out about even asking for help, right? But if they know they can log into Sonya and just with very little friction, just start chatting with someone, I thought that was a really powerful tool.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Yeah, I remember our first conversation. I really liked how excited you got, and I was super excited myself because like that's exactly what we're trying to do, right? We're really making it accessible. Therapy is great. Therapy works. Most people can't access therapy. We want to build something that is accessible anytime, anywhere, and for anyone.
Yeah. And I certainly, like, you know, could empathize with it, having struggled with some of my own things growing up and having to get over them and seeing a therapist. But, you know, those are expensive. $175 an hour. Does your insurance cover it? You know, like the time commitment of like driving somewhere and driving back and sitting with somebody for an hour versus like, hey, I can just get in. So how do you guys kind of grease the skids of user acquisition? Is there a freemium kind of model where you can chat for 5 minutes a day and then you have to convert? Like, how's that work?
Yeah. So we did a bunch of exploration there. Fundamentally, what we came up to now is your first few sessions are free and then we convert to a subscription model.
That's really cool. And so like you kind of get the benefit, and then if you want to keep going, hey, it's a low monthly price to upgrade. What is that monthly price?
$20 per month right now.
And it's month to month, no like annual commit or anything like that?
Yeah. I mean, we have an annual membership, which some people have as well, which is $200 per month. So it's a slight discount for that.
Yeah, $200 a year. So it's a little bit of a discount. So what do you
pretty much try to have it as like, instead of $200 per session, you pay $200 per year for therapy. That's kind of the slogan we want to have around it.
I love that. And, you know, I think this is, I mean, we're kind of living in the future in a way, like, you know, in the coming years with apps like this, you could see for the most part, you know, do you feel like therapists go away? Do you feel like they become like travel agents where they're still around, but they've sort of been kind of automated away with better AI? How do you think about that?
Yeah, like I definitely don't think anywhere in the short / medium term. I think like there's obviously like the larger question around AGI, which you could argue will replace all our jobs and everything each of us do. But I think fundamentally the gap between demand and supply for therapy is so extremely large that I think not us or anyone else trying to build an AI therapist is interested in going after the jobs of therapists. We're much more like trying to be inspired by the jobs of therapists. Sometimes it's even an interesting distribution network, right? Because one use case of Sonia could be if you try to visit a therapist, but they have a wait list of 4 months, you could have them use Sonia during that time. Because like obviously if you're in a crisis for anxiety or depression, you can't just like put that on hold for 4 months until your therapist finally has an appointment. But that could be valuable also for the therapist, right? Like potentially it's a new way for them to monetize their waitlist, something they weren't able to retrieve any revenue from previously. Or it can also make the first few in-person sessions when they fundamentally eventually come more effective because they already have context from Sonia sessions. Sonia maybe already did a lot of the onboarding, maybe already helped the patient to some extent, and now we can then offboard that information to a therapist. So I think like there's actually a lot of partnership opportunities. Clearly, there's a lot of pushback from therapists. They kind of like splits up into like three categories of like therapists just being like directly like anti-AI, which I think many people still are today. But we have also encountered and met and are working together with a lot of great therapists who just like fundamentally see mental health care being a large problem. They dedicate their lives to making therapy accessible, right? So I think if you fundamentally care about the patients, it isn't even the most important thing of who gives therapy. Right, if we can just like collectively with AI technology, humans, and all other support systems manage to treat those 70 million Americans, I think that's what fundamentally counts. And like, if there could be more treatments with humans than with AIs in an efficient manner, then AI should be used for that industry, right? But I think fundamentally here, it just unlocks a huge opportunity to make that more scalable.
Yeah, and it's kind of like maybe it grows the pie, right? Maybe there's a Jevons paradox that happens where, you know, with the automation, more therapy than ever is done, right? It doesn't replace, but augments and democratizes access to therapy. And maybe there's more demand for therapists than ever because people get a taste of it with an app like Sonia, and then they see the value and they want to talk to a human now. Or like you said, there's a partnership where, you know, maybe I see a therapist once or twice a month, and then on a daily or weekly basis, I actually talk to the AI about what's going on. So now the therapist is armed with all the insights. It's almost like having assistant therapists seeing all your patients and helping you manage the caseload.
Yeah, I mean, if I'd be a therapist, I'd be excited. the way you just said that, like it helps me in many ways, I think.
How do you guys manage the regulatory hurdles, if any, in the industry? And are there some roadblocks that you know, the regulators are going to try to throw your way?
Yeah, so I'd almost say, like, unfortunately, there's not many regulatory hurdles in this space. I personally think there should probably be more than there are. And the reason for that being, it's pretty easy to get around it, right? Like, because it's a hard line to draw between a therapist and a mental health support tool and just a chatbot. So I think, like, there's easy ways you can just say, this is not a therapist, this is not a replacement, and it should not be intended for crisis situations, which fundamentally we, by the way, all believe, right? Like,
right.
We don't think Sonia should be used for crisis situations. We don't think Sonia is a replacement for a therapist. So, like, that's very much in line with how we anyways want to build our product and distribute that to the world. But with that, you basically take care of that not being a medical device and the regulatory concerns. I think what we fundamentally care a lot about is just the privacy and the security, right? Which I think are two distinct aspects. Privacy, like, what information do we even collect? How do we handle that information? Like, how do we give you a secure feeling? And then the security being mostly around also what happens if things really go south? How do we detect crisis situations? How do we act when we detect crisis situations? Because, right, there's moments where a human should not be talking to Sonia. And currently what we have is we have a detection algorithm which escalates that process to national hotlines. But we actually want to go way beyond that, because you shouldn't also just see a screen that says you can call this number. Somebody should, like, proactively reach out to you, already have the context about what happened. Because, like, in those situations, it's really, like, every minute counts. And, like, somebody being empathetically able to have background and help you from second one is so much worth more than you having to go on a hotline and, like, explain the entire situation again.
Yeah. Yeah, that totally makes sense. What are you excited for, you know, the coming year or two with Sonia? What do you guys have on the roadmap that's exciting you can talk about?
I think generally, if you think about building a therapist, and there's actually, like, the analogy of, if I were a normal therapist and I just graduated college and I'm starting to see patients, there's so much room for myself to improve, right? Like, as I see more patients, as I learn more, as I go to more additional workshops, maybe get my PhD, I just become fundamentally better. And I think, like, in a similar way, we see Sonia as this newly graduated therapist, which has a base layer of skills. We obviously put a lot of effort into making sure Sonia is already therapeutically effective, and I've gotten feedback there. But now it's really about, like, continuously increasing the amount of capabilities that Sonia has, making that more therapeutically effective, being able to have more case distinctions about different types of anxiety, knowing that different types of anxieties require different interventions, different techniques, or, like, really building up that skill set.
Yeah.
And just, like, getting Sonia closer and closer to the world's best therapist.
Do you think in the future we are living in the movie Her, and there's just, like, generally applicable AI companions that are horizontally good at everything? Or do you think in the future it kind of unfolds into these verticals, and, you know, there's these companies built around individual use cases of verticals like Sonia?
I think definitely not entirely horizontal, but I think there's potentially relatively broad verticals, right? I think there doesn't need to be a single application for each and every specific use case, but I definitely believe, right, like, your AI system for your emotional well-being and your emotional life will be a different one than for your work life. I think, like, from a very functional perspective, but also from a user experience perspective, because you don't want to intertwine those two things. You don't want, like, the data that schedules your work trips and meetings to be mixed with the data around you talking about your most recent breakup and how you can't get over that, right? I think, like, the user wants to have certain environments for certain parts of their life. And within those environments, the more synergies we can have, the more convenient I think it is for the user. And I think that's also an interesting avenue for Sonia down the road, is not only actively helping you get over those specific emotions, but then, like, more proactively helping you solve those root problems. Like, how can you become more happy in a relationship? Maybe at some point, like, your partner can also join Sonia, and it's, like, even suggest you things outside of the pure therapy sessions. So I think it's kind of like a domain vertical horizontal solution.
I can imagine in the future an app like Sonia is actually, if I give it permission, obviously, like, listening to this podcast recording and listening to my Zoom calls and reading my emails, and is like this you know little angel on my shoulder, basically kind of saying, hey, did you realize your tone is kind of, you know, flat or angry, or, you know, hey, you seem disgruntled about something, you want to talk about it? Like, you'll have this emotional AI companion in the future, and you won't have to proactively go out and download the Sonia app and start talking about it. Like, in the future, you might just plug into it and just say, hey, I'm feeling malaise or whatever. And it'll just know all these things about you. Right. And be able to proactively beyond what you talk about, but like how you act and with other people and what you say and what you do. And
yeah, that'll be really, and it gives, really, yeah, it gives Sonia more context to be effective, right? If I do Sonia session later on today and I'm like, oh, I'm super tired, today was an exhausting day, and it already knows, like, oh, I had 7 meetings and it had recordings of those meetings and it knew how I behaved. Like, also, you need to have that extremely privacy first, yeah, in every regards, because otherwise I think it just kills the entire user experience and they wouldn't want all of that. But assuming that you can achieve that, it's just additional signal which can be therapeutically used.
Yeah. What about, so tell me about your transition from competitive poker. What was that? How much money were you making? Were you doing tournaments? And how did that kind of, you know, did you get to this point? Like, I had this job in college where I was making a ton of money. And I was like, do I need to finish college? Like, did you, did thoughts like that kind of cross your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't make millions. I made a decent amount of money. And yeah, for poker, it's funny because to some extent, it matters how good you are. But to a large extent, it matters in what games you play. And you start off playing your local casino games, which are just like capped at their buy-ins, at their blind levels. But like, if you start meeting the right people and you get into the right private games, like, stakes significantly go up and the quality of player significantly goes down. But it's like this weird dynamic of like, you also can't just sit there.
Local casino games are actually more competitive with a lower cap of what you can make versus like these private games at somebody's house that, you know, you get a bunch of rich people sitting around throwing tens of thousands of dollars around and losing it.
Infinitely more, yeah. Like, casino games, and like, the more convenient it is and the easier it is to get in, like, the harder the games get. Like, online games are way tougher than live games, and then live games are way tougher than private games. But that also like creates this dynamics of when you start playing those private games, you can't just continuously play optimal, right? Like, your optimal strategy, like, you probably focus, you like listen to your music, you have your hoodie up, whatever, but then like, people don't like you there,
and like, there was, they don't want you back. Yeah.
Exactly. Some of those players, they know, like, yeah, they are, it's a hobby that is a costly hobby for them, but they want to have a good time and they want to be entertained. So like, sometimes you need to like adjust your playing style to like a more splashy, gambling way. And in some situations you need to like make decisions which are an expected value negative, but you know, it will help your image. And like, if somebody wants to gamble, like at some, there's some of those games where somebody just wants to gamble like $1,000 if like the next card will be black or red, which is like something I wouldn't want to do per se, but if it's like,
a 50-50 chance.
Yeah, like expected value, it's here. It's kind of like pointless, but it's a lot about network. And I think there's very good parts about that, and I think there's very bad parts about it. The good parts is, I think it's very reflective to how a lot of things in life work, right? How you have a strategy, how intelligence matters, how you need to be prepared. Theory is important, but practice fundamentally looks very different. And it all boils down to just a people's problem with also a lot of psychological elements. I think that was like one of my first touch points with parts of psychology as well. Variance is huge. I think that's another lesson for life. That,
what is it?
Expected value, variance.
Oh, variance, like
The differentiation between variance and expected value, that if you play the same strategy in poker every day, if you're a good player, you have like a 65 to 70% win day rate. So even if you play perfectly, like 30% of days, you're just going to lose money. And that's fine if you
So the optimal strategy peaks out at about 65, 70% of the time you're winning. So you're always going to lose at least a third, if not 30, 40, 50% of the time.
Yeah. Which, like, I think similar in life, right? Like, we have 3 YC interviews. I'm always the same person. We get rejected twice, which is like fine because it's like a combination of a bunch of variables, but you just like need to persevere enough and like give yourself enough opportunities and things will go right. But all that being said, which is also why I don't play much poker anymore, I think like fundamentally the problem of it is just like it's a zero-sum game. I think it's fascinating from a mathematical component and some good lessons for life, but fundamentally you're either losing money or taking money away from people who lose it, which I think both are not great things.
Yeah, at the table it's zero-sum kind of, right? Like you lose, I win, you know, basically. It's not 1 + 1 = 3. It's like, you know, 3 - 1 = 2 for me, you know?
Yeah, which is a cool thing now, right? Like, I think it's very net positive what we do. And I tried to, like, counter a bunch of that by donating a lot of the money I won with poker. I did, like, a lot of, like, just independent, like, philanthropic projects. Like, just get a lot of food and, like, give it to homeless or work with shelters.
Feel good about that.
And put, like, parts of my money in there. But, like
Robin Hood or something. You know, stealing poker money from the rich, giving it to the poor.
Yeah, I guess, like, it's a very small extent. But that's why I would never have wanted to spend my entire life playing poker. I think it's like a pretty cool hobby you have in high school and college. It's cool to like prove people wrong, right? Because like once you start going to a casino as like an 18-year-old on a Friday night, people just think you're a gambling addict. And it's kind of like being able to prove that wrong, I also thought was pretty
fun.
So
how do you think it informed your, you know, how you live your life, how you run a startup, how you think about the world?
I think about the world generally a lot in probabilities. I think that even started before poker, but it got definitely like reinforced in poker, right? Like in a poker hand, you continuously just like readjust your probabilities. And like based on that, you calculate your expected value, you know, how much you bet, like how much you risk and like if it's worth it. And I just like in very like daily mundane things, I think about probability. Like, oh, is that going to happen? Like probably like a 20% chance. And like, given that it's 20%, like it just allows you
odds on all your activities and in your daily life, basically.
Pretty much. Yeah. Like it just, I actually think it's like sometimes a helpful framework to quantify things.
Yeah.
Right. Like it allows you to rationalize decisions. Obviously there's an emotional part to like how you even map that to a probability, but like having that probability allows you to like calculate EV and it like becomes less emotional decision oftentimes. And second being, what I touched on a tiny bit is really like being aware of variance in life. And I think that is very, very much the case for startups. And I think like you definitely know that as an investor, right? Like I'm sure you wish all of your startups would just like end up being unicorns, but like they don't. And like, because they don't, you need to adjust your strategy. Like you have a certain fund size and you need to like, oh, how many of those bets can I have? Like you shouldn't put your entire fund in one company. That's the same for like, 100%. Even if you're a great poker player, you shouldn't bet all your money in a single night, because like if those 30% kick in, you're broke.
Well, in fact, that's a big part of my strategy as a money manager is I assume I'm bad at this. And if I assume I'm bad at this, what is the optimal strategy? Because maybe I'm good at this, maybe I'm excellent at this, but even if I was bad at this, there is a optimal strategy if I'm bad at this. And then let's just start from that baseline, from that variance calculation. And then if I'm good, then it's even better, right?
That's probably the thing, right? Because like, if you assume you're bad, but you're good, you get most of the upside from just purely being good. But if you assume you're good and you're bad, then you're fully problematic.
Then you over-concentrate. You only make 15 bets in your fund and they all blow up and you're done and you're out of the industry. But for me, like for each of our vehicles, we usually make 100, 150 investments, you know, so, you know, even if we're really bad at this, we should hit one or two outliers, just the average. And that's like if you look at like A16Z or Sequoia, they're still only hitting 2 or 3% unicorns in their portfolio. They just make a lot of bets, you know, they just make a lot of bets. Whereas YC is like, depending on the data set you look at, it's 5 or 10% unicorn hit rate. And so, you know, for me as an investor, I need to make enough bets. So probabilistically, statistically, I'm very likely to have, you know, one or two of these like big, you know, 100,000x, 10,000x kind of outliers. So that's, a little bit of sausage making for VC firms there for you. Yeah, I love this. Let's wrap up with like a rapid fire round.
Let's do it.
What book has significantly influenced your life or career?
One book that we actually use a lot in the way we do decisions at our startup is based off the letters from Jeff Bezos. And I think they're all collected in, I think the book is called Invent and Wander.
Ah.
And he shares like all the shareholder letters. He shares a lot of learnings on how he does decisions.
Invent and Wander.
I disagree and commit. I think that's how he calls it.
Yeah.
And we use that a lot internally in our founding teams. Like we know there's some areas where one person takes the lead, but like even for those areas, all three should voice their opinions. But like, if sometimes opinions don't agree and like, you argue, or I guess you discuss to a certain extent, but then like, you can also just disagree and commit, right?
Yeah.
You don't necessarily need to agree before you commit, and you don't need to just like commit before you even talk to others because you're scared that they'll have different opinions. But it's like, I can confidently sometimes just like say, okay, I listened to your opinion. I disagree. I think here I have more background. Like I'll decide. But like same thing, like Dustin can do the same thing. Lucas can do. And I think like, if you embrace that culture, you avoid everybody ever being upset because you ignored your opinion. Because like you don't ignore it. You listen to it, but you disagree.
Yeah, the first part, and I worked at AWS, Amazon, years ago. The first part of that cultural principle is have backbone. Mm-hmm. Have backbone, disagree and commit. And yeah, what you're describing is like, don't be afraid to speak up. And Amazon was probably the best working, running company and fastest moving company I've ever worked for, easily.
Yeah.
Because of all those cultural principles that Bezos put into the culture, that it just made it there's this meritocracy for the size of the company had very little politics when I was there. It was just like, it was practical and you use data to make decisions and influence people in the written word. And just so many things of how the company ran was just so different from anything else I've experienced.
Did you guys actively use also the concept of, I think he calls like type one and type two decisions?
Like, yeah, you know, you one-way door, two-way door. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Is this a one-way door or a two-way door? I love that, right? Some decisions are two-way doors. Like, we can reverse ourselves. And some things are existential. And like, once we walk through that door, we have to commit forever. I love that. Yeah. Yeah. So many good and books, like you said, have been written on it. So what's your favorite non-work related activity?
Spending time with family. Yeah, my family's far away, but I call them every day.
That's amazing. You fly back to, is it Zurich where you're from? Or?
Yeah. I mean, I fly back occasionally, but also just a lot of FaceTime. But now we're quite used to it. It's been a few years since I've been in the U.S., but
oh, wow.
I call with them every day.
Yeah, I love Switzerland. I think I'll spend part of the year there eventually. I have some friends, actually, that I went to grad school with that live there. Yeah, that's a great place. What's one AI technology you believe will revolutionize the future?
I mean, I hope it is going to be what we build.
Yeah.
I think there's many, but... definitely have a lot of conviction in AI for healthcare in general and specifically mental health, of course.
So you have 24 hours and you can either do a poker or coding marathon. Which one do you do?
I actually already did both simultaneously at some point in my life. I used to study law for university undergrad at the poker table and did some coding there. But I don't think I've ever fully done 24 hours of poker. I've definitely done 24 hours of coding, so might need to test the latter.
I always wanted to play a video game for 24 hours. I never got around to doing it.
Really?
Yeah. during COVID, I was playing a lot of video games because, I don't know, we're just sitting around, not able to go anywhere. I always wanted to just sit down and just play a video game for 24 hours. I never did.
What's the longest you made?
I mean, as a kid, I probably put in a solid, 18, 20 hours. But as an adult, I don't know if I put in more than 8. I still play video games every day, but it's like an hour, an hour at night from like 10 to 11 or something like that. What's the most challenging aspect of starting a business in the mental health space?
There's a few. I think like one challenge we definitely faced in the last few months is there's a lot of skepticism towards mental health apps. Which I think like fundamentally just stems from the fact that for the last, I don't know, like 4 or 5 years, it's been a huge hype and it's been very much over-promised, under-delivered. I think like, now is like the first time where fundamentally there's a technology shift. And I think like technology shifts usually unlock a lot. And before that, it was kind of like recycling the same technology with like some different designs and front ends. But like there's clearly skepticism around that. And by now, like people have tried a bunch of mental health apps and like being able to not seem like just another one of those is quite a big challenge for us.
If you could solve one problem with AI in the world, what would it be besides what you're working on?
I think I'd still have it in the same category of just like happiness, but I don't think that necessarily only holds for AI therapy. I think, right, like a lot of happiness can stem from productivity boosts, can stem from potentially like developer tooling and so on. I think, but like, fundamentally, I'd love the objective function to sometimes be more around human happiness than pure money, which I think is impractical in some ways. And like, obviously, there's areas where the two are very aligned, which I think is like the perfect case. But I think it's just like very much the focus is often on the dystopian parts of AI productivity. And I think like if you can just like focus on the utopian parts of it, like how do we actually like use this to improve people's lives?
Yeah.
Which I think there's so many options of. I think it'd be cool to sometimes like even just like the news and everything focus more on that than purely like, oh, we'll lose our jobs.
Yeah. And I think the big unlock for AI will really be it enabling us to discover who we truly are and what we're made to do. Mm-hmm. Right. And, I was going to ask a follow up question. It's like, what makes us happy? What do you think makes us happy?
I think it's very individual. I think happiness is just like this. It's almost like a state of lack of unhappiness. It's like there's many things that make you unhappy, and the avoidance of those I think oftentimes is happiness. But I think it's like happiness is oftentimes, I at least not for myself, like happiness is like I'm just like care, like without any sorrow or like concerns, regrets, or whatever, like somewhere out in the nature, like sunlight shining on me, and like I can just like sit there potentially with like people I love around me. That's like a state of like tranquility and happiness. But I think it's mainly defined by like the lack of unhappiness.
Right.
I think that's why AI is very interesting, because AI can get rid of a lot of unhappiness, which is bound to responsibilities and problems we face in daily life.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, I would tweak it a little bit and say, it's kind of like it's enjoying what you're doing and enjoying who you're doing it with. Right. It's kind of like, oh, like I'm free to create for the world what I want to create. And I enjoy the process of that creation, and I enjoy the people I'm working with creating it. Right. And that really comes from inside. It's intrinsic. Right. And I think AI like will shine that mirror to us, you know, pull up that mirror and make us look at ourselves and really figure that out. And, you know, I'll talk to lots of young people in their 20s and they're like, I want to work in venture. I'm like, why do you want to work in venture? Like, what do you actually like doing? You know, like for me, I do like what I do. Like I like doing the podcast, and if I had $1 billion, I'd be doing this podcast with you right now. Like, and I just like what I do. Right. But it took me 20 years of trying things to figure that out. And so a lot of people just never figure that out. They're just sort of like, kind of just, I don't know. I just kind of go to work and yeah, I like my job. It's pretty good. And you know, and they don't, they're not really figuring out exactly like what they like to do. Right. And everybody has something or multiple things.
Yeah. I think you definitely have more than one. I think like the challenge and hard part will be if we need to almost like unlearn to tie success to monetary outcome.
Right.
Cause I think like, as you say, it's about like finding out what you enjoy doing, and like you measure what you're doing to like some extent, and that extent has been money for so long. Mm. And I think like with end stage AGI, it can't be money, because like the money will always be bound to like the value you create in the economy. And that's going to be taking care of the AI. And it's like, it really needs to go like fundamentally more intrinsically of like your own sense of satisfaction with that happiness. Just like what makes you smile. And like, you need to also be around people who know that if you do and pursue what makes you smile and what makes other people smile, like that is the goal, right? Because like today, so many people think like the goal is to make money. They don't say it directly, but it's like always what it boils down to. And I think like we also need to like unlearn that to get there.
Yeah, because I think in the future you'll like, to your point, like AI and robotics is going to basically drop the input costs of capitalism to near zero, or very, very, very cheap. So everything will get super abundant. And then it won't be a question of making money anymore, because there's so much abundance. It'll be a question of creating meaning, right? And creating things that you want to create for the world. Like I love music, but I don't like creating songs. I like playing songs. I can play guitar, but I don't actually enjoy the process of writing songs down. So I'll never be a songwriter, I don't think. But I really like meeting people and learning about them and what they're building, which makes me a great venture capitalist. Because if you ever get into this period, if I ever got into this period where, and this hasn't happened, I've been doing this for 5 years now, but where I was like, I don't want to meet any more founders. That would be like the end of my career. You know what I mean? Like, because I love that process. And even my LPs, shout out to all my LPs. Like, they're really interesting people and I love talking to them, right? So you have to find that thing that you love doing. I love the process of doing what I'm doing, but it took me, again, 20 years of iterating, trying things before I found it.
Did you notice in any significant way when you found that? Was it like kind of like a light bulb aha moment, like this is it? Was that like after
kind of gradual? Kind of gradual, yeah. Because I was at like angel investing for a couple of years, and then I did the syndicate for a couple of years. And it was in the process of angel investing that I realized, oh, I really like talking to founders and helping them, right? Yeah. This is really fun. I get a lot of vicarious satisfaction from this process. And
that's great.
Yeah, it's great.
I mean, it clearly shines through. That's what I really appreciate. Like, as I said already from the first conversation, like, it's clear that you like what you're doing, which you can see as a founder want to work with people who like working with you and don't only just care about what you might become in 10 years.
I mean, it's a grind. I won't lie. It's like, I meet 15 new people every day. That's my life. But I love meeting new people, so it works. And because I get to learn about them and their backgrounds, and that's why I'm doing the podcast, right? Because I get to go deeper with you, who's really interesting founder, building something interesting, and it kind of works. And if it didn't, I'd stop doing it, right? Even if I had $1 billion, I'd keep doing this. I'd just probably have a staff and everything would be more polished. And you probably wouldn't meet me until you met like one or two of my team members, right? I wouldn't take the first calls. I'd take second or third calls or whatever, but I'd still do what I do. You know, I'd probably own a basketball team or something, but well, I mean, I live east of Sacramento now, so probably the Kings, but the Warriors, I'm still a Warriors fan. So I spent over a decade in the Bay and watched the whole Steph Curry rise and now sort of the end of the dynasty. Hopefully not, but that's where it's going, I think. But yeah, man, this has been a great conversation. I could talk to you for another hour and just dig into all the aspects, but we'll have to have you back on at some point in the future. Thanks so much for coming on.